Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment, food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from. American Glutton is brought to you by Trifecta. Maintenance has been the most important aspect of weight loss for me, and nothing has helped me more in that department than Trifecta. Visit Trifecta.com today to find out why they're the best at what they do. Today on American Glutton, my guests are Chef Daniel Holzman and award-winning food journalist Matt Rodbard. They're here to talk about their new book, Food IQ, 100 Questions, Answers, and Recipes to Raise Your Cooking Smarts. I'm excited to talk to them about the culture of food and the simple way they break down cooking for everyone at home. You can find them on Instagram at Chef Holzman and at Matt Rodbard. Matt Rodbard and Daniel Holzman, welcome to the American Glutton podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us, buddy.
Real excited.
So for me, one of the biggest changes in my life came about when I learned that I could make stuff, maybe not exactly as delicious as in a restaurant, but I could approach it. And also I then knew what was in it. Like I knew that a lot of the stuff that I loved eating at restaurants had butter in it, or, they were brining stuff with sugar. And there were a lot of tricks in that way. But the other thing that it did is it allowed me to take control over that. And so that when I started to get really serious about dieting, I didn't feel like I was inept in the kitchen. But I do think today in America, we find a situation where a lot of people just don't know what to do. So I'm really excited about your book, Food IQ, which could be very helpful to people.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like for a lot of reasons, Americans don't right now know how to cook. More folks are interested in cooking and fewer folks know how to cook than ever before in our history. It started in the 40s when, between advertising and second wave feminism, people specifically stopped learning how to cook. And then, it's something that's handed down through the generations. You learn how to cook from somebody. And so in a world where people really are rediscovering this, it's the greatest gift you can give yourself, because as you say, it gives you the opportunity to make choices. And when you can make choices, mm-hmm. you can, what choices you make are on you. But giving you the empowerment to make those choices is something that I think everybody should have.
Yeah, I mean that's it. That's even an interesting slant that I hadn't considered. but like just the familial recipes are disintegrating. I know most of the people I know have an aunt with a recipe that's the best version of the thing. Mm-hmm. And those are always really good. But then just in a general sense, I grew up with my mom and dad both worked, and a home cooked meal was like an occasion. It wasn't a nightly practice.
Mm-hmm. Do you grow up eating fast food and eating processed food just because your age, and I'm assuming we're all similar age?
I would go back and forth like that. My mom would put me on diets that were all, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I was put on all the fad diets as a kid. And so I would be eating, you know, macrobiotic food at one point, or, you know, candida food at another point. And so I was being fed these meals that were very different than the way my family was eating. And they were eating a lot of fast food. And then when people gave up on me in dieting, it was all fast food.
I think the idea of the recipe is interesting. I'd like to marinate on that a bit, pun intended, of course. I feel like we right now are reading more recipes than ever as consumers of food media. That's where I come from. I'm a writer, a journalist, so to speak, or a food writer, and Daniel's a chef. So I create recipe content as my job at Taste, where I'm editor-in-chief. So I know there's this behavior of reading food content and reading food media, but people, as we have acknowledged, are not cooking as much. So with our book, we're trying to kind of negotiate the idea of what does a cookbook mean? Because right now we think that, yes, cookbooks stand as a document to cook from, but also cookbooks are there to teach you about food, about culture, to grasp some cultural currency that we think that food is these days. It's not about watch collecting. It's about collecting tahinis in the back of your, it's not just the health food store of tahini. It's like the artisanal tahini. That's what, you know, people talk about, men, women. I think
that's really very pointless. I often find myself in a conversation with somebody who, when I hear them talking about food, I think, man, I don't think this person actually knows how to cook. But like, they sure as shit sound really they're asking me questions about food stuff. I'm like, I don't think I know what that means. Like this guy right. The other day was like, you know, what's your favorite way to make like asafoetida something or
other? Asafoetida?
I don't even know what you're talking about, man. I'm like a professional chef.
Yeah. Pretty impressive. Asafoetida, by the way, is called hing. And it's this powder that is cooked. It's used in Indian cooking. And it's like, it's basically natural MSG. And it's like when you eat at Indian restaurants, you often will taste this deeply seasoned salt, but it's not like kosher salt. It's like, it like excites the tongue. You get it on like lots of different dishes, and that's asafoetida anyways.
I can't wait to mess around with that. I'm a big fan of MSG personally. This is a controversial subject, but I was raised thinking MSG will kill you. And then through a little research and going to places, yes.
That's a question about MSG. Yes.
I haven't read the book, so I hope you're friendly towards it. It seems like you are.
We you know, for me, MSG plays a really big part in my cooking, and Matt and I have talked about it from the very beginning, as it's just one of the most misunderstood. And it's such a funny time in our lives because it's a time when, you know, the public outcry and, you know, has changed the commercially produced, you know, packaged foods in a way where they're taking all these ingredients out. At the same time, chefs are starting to discover the same ingredients and put them in food and say, hey, wait a second, these are, you know, this like MSG is magic. And as they try and take it out of packaged food, unfortunately, what happens is they find a way to put it back in a way that is usually less healthy, usually has other ingredients associated with it to hide it. Mm-hmm. Because people don't like to just, I would rather see on my package MSG than 9 other chemicals that will create the compound.
Yeah. 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 And if we're being like really honest, if you're talking to somebody about wanting to lose weight or be healthier, the thing in Doritos that is causing obesity is or health problems is not the MSG. It's just not, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously not a dietitian. And so it's hard for me because I can only speak to what's worked for me personally. And ultimately, it seems like being conscious of what you're eating is the number one goal, right? Like actually paying attention every day to what you eat is going to do, and whatever diet you choose is going to put you leagues and light years ahead of any other choice. Like you're just making a conscious choice. You know what's going in your body. You're looking at your food. That's going to get you 90% of the way there. If for me, at least, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I have no disagreements. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and then you become addicted to the experience of the healthfulness, and you see the actual physical change, and it becomes a self-fulfilling driving force for you, right? Like it's like it's easy. Counting calories is a real pain in the butt, and then when you start to see the weight come off, you think that's exciting.
Yeah, and then you have a motivational benefit. But I squirm slightly simply because, being raised on fad diets, I had a period in my life where I was told lectins are going to kill me and all of my weight issues will be solved if I don't eat lectins. And so suddenly my mom's peeling the cucumber and de-seeding it. And like, that's all I had to do. You know, it was this idea that there's one thing, it's the carbohydrates that are poisoning everybody. If you just stop eating those. And for me, those were never remedies in real terms. So being conscious of those things, I think I like what you're saying, like overall, be conscious of what you're eating. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the point where you're like, this one food is the problem, unless you have some allergy or autoimmune, I then start to go like, okay, if you just hadn't had MSG, your life would be okay. I don't know if I can buy that, you know?
Well, we were talking earlier about, you know, one diet that really does work is making your food not taste good.
Yeah.
Right. Because you just eat less. And MSG definitely enhances flavor. So, you know, there is an argument that says MSG makes food taste better. You want to eat more of it.
I'll tell you this. This is a story. I'm friends with a couple of restaurant critics. And one in New York told me once, he's, you know, reviewing 14 to 17 meals a week. He throws salt on all of his desserts.
Wow.
He has one bite and literally salts it. Cause like, you know, it's just the only way he's going to stop eating is to throw salt on the dessert. So I think it reminds me of that. It's like, that is truly one of the easiest ways to not eat. Right.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I experienced was like when I first got very serious on a diet and I got super excited about cooking, I was like sublimating my experience with all these tasty foods that I was withholding from myself by cooking them for my kids. So I would make these elaborate meals. And part of that like taught me how to feel confident in the kitchen. Like I knew that the stuff I was churning out was good because it was all getting eaten and asked for seconds, et cetera. But then like, I really like what you're saying. Like there is a point where like, not having to make the food exciting all the time is a useful tool in a diet.
I mean, when you, backing up a little bit,
you're a chef. I don't want to offend you with this.
No, it's not offensive.
I'm feeling the vibes here. I'm just kidding.
That's, you know, what excites me and what I enjoy is making food taste delicious as it can taste. And, you know, in some cases that means taking frozen vegetables off the shelf at the supermarket and saying, hey, when we wrote Food IQ, we really said, let's try and take our personal biases out of the equation. A lot of this started, Matt had an was cooking with some canned beans and I was making fun of him and saying, you know, you're lazy.
He's trolling me on Instagram. Yeah. Truly. That's the story of this one.
Ultimately. So, you know, we basically said, well, why don't we take our biases out of this and really say, hey, let's taste what these canned beans taste like. Let's cook with frozen food. Let's cook with packaged foods and see what is really there. And we have a lot of biases that come from 50, 60, 70 years ago. You know, like I think of canned beans as being terrible or frozen vegetables being terrible because of what I learned in my childhood, which was literally 40 years ago, right? And they weren't that great, but technology has changed and there's new opportunities and we constantly have to question what is out there and give ourselves a second chance.
And I'd say another bias is snobbery. Like I come from a world of food writing and I think we are the snobbiest group of people around. Like we put everything, we covet seasonality, rightly so in most cases, but sometimes we go a little overboard. But as we write in Food IQ, like frozen vegetables are great. Like there are certain frozen vegetables, like peas, for example, you cook with frozen peas. Those are the greatest peas you're going to ever have. Have you ever tried to like cook from peas in like May on the East Coast from the farmer's market after shelling for 15 minutes? They're not that good. So in the book, our point is that we are like, yes, cook with frozen peas. Yes, cook with some frozen fish, but also make this risotto recipe that's like right at the end of the page, at the end of the question, because we feel like Food IQ is like not just reading the answer, but applying it through a recipe. And that's what we do in the book. Each question has a recipe. So like this risotto, frozen's great. And what's another frozen food?
I'm dying to know what your frozen fish suggestions are. Like what fish freezes well?
The thing about fish, you know, is the technology again has really, there's been light years of leaps where, you know, they're freezing stuff individually, quick frozen IQF on the boat when it comes out of the water. And so they're locking in the freshness. Now, the faster you freeze something, the less the cell structure of the actual food is broken down. So you don't get that freezer burn, right? When you go to, I get a lot of frozen food from Costco. I get a lot of frozen food from Whole Foods, now owned by Amazon. So actually the quality of the frozen section has gone way up, interestingly enough. Wow. And the price has gone way down, interestingly enough. But you know, what I found is shrimp have always been, you know, a great frozen fish product, seafood product. Shellfish in general tends to freeze well, like scallops, you find scallops. But all of those individually packaged pieces of salmon, cod, halibut, that, you know, the choice that you make of how you want to cook it is what's going to as well affect the quality of your outcome, right?
So, I'd also like to wait. I want to know your suggestions for defrosting it too. This is where I run into some issues.
That's a great call. And I'll just, can I just jump in too and say, when you're buying fish in the fish counter, that's frozen. So like the whole process, and you bring up defrosting, that is what you're paying the $36 a pound for. It's the defrosting technique. So you go,
Yeah. I mean, the best way to defrost something is slowly.
Yeah.
Right. The best way to freeze something is quickly. The best way to defrost is slowly. So if you could defrost in your refrigerator overnight, it's going to maintain its integrity or as much as possible. For me, the real choice you get to make is then how you want to cook it. So frozen salmon always has a bit of a fishy flavor to me. So I tend to cook frozen salmon with a stronger, more flavorful sauce. Yeah. Frozen, you know, fattier fish tend to get a little bit more of a fish flavor when after they've been frozen, especially fish with skin on them. Mm-hmm. Whereas like a white flaky fish, like a cod, tends not to really get that. So, you know, and cod has a much lighter flavor profile, right? So maybe you would use a lighter flavored sauce.
You would poach a cod and you would grill a mackerel. Hard sear grill a mackerel because of that fat content. But with cod, you can, you know, it's much lighter. So I think that's saucing is a great example, right?
And then we had a fun because, you know, I grew up in a place, in a home with a hippie mom who was anti-microwave and anti-frozen and anti-air conditioning and anti-TV and, you know, anything that had bad fun. Meanwhile, she's 80 years old and riding her bike to the beach with the kids. So like whatever she did, it worked. So I don't want to disparage it. Like turns out the hippies were right. Yeah. But you know, so it was an opportunity. Writing Food IQ is an opportunity to explore, like, what does the microwave do? Is it going to, you know, is it immediately going to kill me or make my food taste bad and give me bad vibes? Or are there, or is it a tool that has really great qualities that I should consider using for certain things? And when we paired frozen fish with microwave poaching, you find, man, you can actually get a really delicious, healthy, flavorful meal in like 15 minutes.
Really?
We take a piece of frozen cod, we put mushrooms and a little bit of butter, white wine and salt, and you put a piece of plastic wrap over the top, microwave it, and then let it sit so that, you know, frozen cooks on the outside, the middle stays frozen, it steams its way through, and it's like, man, like, you know, you're talking about like dormitory bachelor level cooking that's delicious.
Or I'll add where this question kind of was hashed out is in our conversation. So in the book, we talked several hours per question and we were Zooming a lot during the pandemic. He learned that at Le Bernardin. I'm just going to say it. That's where Daniel worked at Le Bernardin. Eric Appert blurbed our book. Great guy. This is not their normal cooking, but I think anyone who knows anything about restaurants, the microwave is used often. And at Le Bernardin, as we write, there is a microwave involved in one of the dishes, right?
I mean, that that might be my infamous legacy of Le Bernardin was introducing microwave cooking. I should be both embarrassed and maybe like, you know, burned at the stake. So
this is heretic. I was in the kitchen once at Le Bernardin and it looked like a NASA research room. It was so clean. I couldn't believe it. And there were screens with Keller was like zooming in to watch what was happening in the kitchen. It was wild.
I remember as a young man, it was my first job, real kitchen job, and I had to wear white pants. And well, the white pants were the hardest part, you know. White pants, it was all white, but white pants were a thing that you don't really wear in general, not after Labor Day, at least. And right. So that was the biggest challenge for me working there.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And then everybody, from what I saw, I mean, I think I got there at the beginning of service, so it wasn't like deep into the weeds, but everybody's whites were sparkling clean. I don't know how that's possible.
They call it soigner. I mean, everything needs to be in its place. And honestly, it's the sign of definitely the sign of a restaurant with a really tight dress code.
I will say this, though. You know, I work in a pizzeria now and all the guys wear white shirts. And it's like a sign of pride, you know, like you're working with red sauce, you're working in a fast paced environment, yeah. You're hustling through it. You wear this white brand new starch t-shirt. They talk in LA, I guess it's a thing, like you wear it with the folds. Yeah. Like it's out of the box, it's out of the package, it's still got the folds, it's brand new. It's like a sign of pride. And you wear that white t-shirt into the pizzeria, get through the day without a stain. And it's like, you know, I'm better than you.
Right. You are. You're certainly better than me. I couldn't do that.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Do you ever find that the broader social media platforms are a little bit impersonal? Well, I do too. Sometimes it's hard to cut through all the noise on them. So we've started a Patreon. And it's got all the normal things a Patreon podcast typically has, like bonus ad-free and video episodes. But the part I'm loving the most is the American Glutton Discord channel, which is only available through Patreon. If you want to chat about diets or recipes, workout routines or motivation, it's all happening there. So search up American Glutton on Patreon to join the community today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Growing up as a kid, my mom would never let us have real cereal. When I say real cereal, I mean the stuff that you'd find at a normal grocery store. My mom would get us the cardboard shavings at the health food store, and I was always miserable with my cereal. And then I would magically go to my friend's house, and they would have real cereal. And I would be so envious, and I would sit and eat bowl after bowl of delicious frosted goodness, sugary, wonderful stuff. And then I grew up and I was able to buy my own cereal, but that lasted all of 2 minutes because then I started dieting. So cereal left my life entirely. Well, not anymore. Not anymore. Now there's Magic Spoon, which is high protein cereal. My favorite flavor is their peanut butter.
It's incredible. Variety pack. Four flavors are cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. This pack has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and 4 to 5 grams of net carbs. Only 140 calories a serving. It's high protein, has 0 grams of sugar, keto friendly, gluten free, grain free, and soy free. It's incredible. Go to magicspoon.com/glutton and grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code glutton at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember, start your day off right with a delicious bowl of high-protein cereal at magicspoon.com/glutton and use the code glutton to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
So I'm glad the microwave plays some use. This is something that I've been, you know, messing with microwaves for 30-plus years. I still am not totally convinced that I know how to defrost stuff in the microwave. It's so hit or miss to me. So to have some kind of a gauge where I'm looking at it and going like, this is how you accurately use it. You know, there are defrost settings and they never seem to work the same.
Let me say this. I think that the same way that the Instant Pot reinvented and reintroduced the pressure cooker. We're going to see the microwave re-engineered in the near future, you know, where you see, you know, you see it coming out of commercial kitchens where you see microwaves that also employ regular technology of convection ovens. So you see like convection microwaves in toaster ovens at, you know, like you see them in every Starbucks. That's what toasts your toasties up there.
And there's a whole line of cookware. There's a brand called All Day, which I, you know, no plug, no money changing hands, no Venmo in my pocket. But I got to say, they sent me one of their bowls and it has this seal on it. It's a glass bowl with a really like a suction cup on it. And it really, and they have some instructions for cooking with it. And I think to Daniel's point, there is going to be a revolution around the microwave. I think David Chang writes about it as well in his new cookbook too. It's definitely taking the approach of convenience and really just leaning into it and feeling like it's okay to be convenient. We are busy people. There are moments when you should take 6 hours to cook. We have a whole section of projects at the end of the book where we say like using your sourdough a starter to make crackers, like make your own crackers. Like it's really worth it. We have 12 recipes where it's super worth it. But one of the things that's not worth it is like sometimes like cooking fish, as we just noted, and like using this microwave as a tool. It's like, it's okay to cook quickly. Like that's a big part of Food IQ.
And so this brand you're talking about with the lid, that lid doesn't pop off in the microwave, because that's another issue I have.
It is a space. So it has a little vent on it. I'm not bullshitting, it really changed the way I do cook vegetables in the microwave sometimes.
Will you tell me the name again?
It's called All Day, I believe.
All Day.
I can send you the link, but it's cool. Like, but you know, you could definitely use another product too. I think there's definitely other ways to cook in the microwave too. You don't need to have the fancy All Day.
I feel like in general, you know, when it comes to cooking, we're so obsessed with how can I make the thing that I want right this second as fast and easy as possible?
Yeah.
And the answer is, well, you know, that doesn't always work. And I don't think we're always honest with ourselves about that. I think folks that sell cookbooks and sell, you know, food gadgets are always trying to say like, oh, we can sell you this thing that you take a frozen chicken and it's the best roast chicken you've ever had in 12 minutes. And the answer is like, that's really not the case. A great roast chicken, it takes 24 hours to cook. You got to salt it. Ask any chef, you want a great roast chicken? You got to salt it the day before. So if you want chicken that's delicious in 12 minutes, don't make a roast chicken, make a different choice.
And it reminds me of this idea of cooking isn't always the act of cooking time. It's about the preparation. There's recipes where you really just want to think about it in advance with the shopping and then with the brining of meat. We talk about the seasoning and brining and really universally, food should be salted at about 1 to 1.5% by weight. And to us, this is across the board. So we really think there's like probably a misperception about how to season food. And people oftentimes say like this vegetable receives this small amount of salt and this thing needs to be overly salted. But in general, it's using your digital scale pre-salting your meat, salting your vegetables and during active cooking. But that's one of the questions that we really were asked a lot when we were researching this book, when we sent out a questionnaire to like 100 of our friends. It was like, how do you salt? Like it season, you know?
I mean, it's just like the number one question that comes through is, you know, I've got this piece of fish. Here's how I was planning on cooking it. And they list 12 ingredients. You think, okay, well, you know, you're never going to learn how to do anything by overly complicating. The trick is start with salt.
Yeah.
Cook it, see how it tastes. Then you'll know, like, did I add too much salt? Did I add not enough salt? Right. One variable, right? Did I overcook it? Did I undercook it? Very clear. Then you can start to add stuff in once you kind of understand it. And that for me is everything. And when you talked earlier about, you know, about the individual ingredients that you're cooking, every one of them needing to be delicious or every meal having to be, you know, directly flavor based or the flavor centric. For me, it's like a bowl of green beans that are steamed with black pepper are delicious, just full stop. And it doesn't need to have anything more, nothing more complicated than that. Frankly, adding anything is usually going to diminish the quality from there, right? Yeah. So it's like you can be the goal of a chef, especially in California where the ingredients are so good, is like get out of the way of yourself, edit it down, and highlight the quality of what you're serving. Unless it happens to not be that great, in which case, put a sauce on top of it.
No, I completely agree with you. And I will be totally frank today. If I make a chicken breast and some broccoli and some rice or potato, it's going to be delicious to me. There happened to be a point in my life where I don't know if it was the burst of fats or carbohydrates or, you know, hidden MSG even potentially that made me feel like I wasn't getting the same thing from that as I was from a Big Mac and chicken nuggets and sweet and sour sauce. Mm. And so I had to really take a minute where I was like, I want to change the way I'm experiencing food. And I want to be able to enjoy this simpler stuff because there was a learning curve there for my body.
Do you think that's because you were reprogramming your pleasure centers to really appreciate it? Or what do you think that is? As we're animals, right? Evolved of bears looking for honey because it's got high calories and it's going to get us through the winter. And, you know, for the first time in any animal history, there's just an overage of everything. We can have more, you know, food, sex, sleep than we need in order to, you know, be healthy for ourselves. So how do you really reprogram that?
I'm an addict. And so, like, you know, and food is so complicated because, like, booze and drugs, I just don't do. And that's kind of, I don't want to make light of it. It's not that it's simple, but it is simple in that I just don't do it. And whether I struggle with that or not, I just don't do it. Food, you can't turn off, right? You got to consume something. And so I received similar dopamine hits or addictive pleasures in compulsively overeating these really, really calorically high meals. And so it was kind of a reprogramming of like, it took a few years to get to the point where, you know, a tablespoon of gochujang now is going to blow my mind. Whereas it would have taken, you know, an hour at the all you can eat Korean barbecue to get that same kind of hit of pleasure.
Love that you bring up gochujang, to be honest, because I feel like one part about healthful eating in my personal experience, from my experience, is really finding those high impact, low impact ingredients, you know, low fat, zero fat, low carbs, you know, low sodium, but high in flavor. To me, gochujang is a great example. Yes, there is sodium. It's natural from the doenjang, from the bean paste, but you want to find these moments where your palate is just woken up. And like, yeah, like previously I was also eating a lot of fast food and eating things that maybe I thought my pleasure centers were going to be fired by, but then I discovered Korean food. I wrote a book about Korean food back a few years ago. And like, it opened up a world. And if you go to Korea and you actually look at how they cook, how Koreans are cooking, It's not beef based. Beef is more rare there. It is a seafood based diet. It is a peninsula. You can talk all day about Korean food here, but it is like brought it up that in the Korean diet, it's balanced and it's based on these jangs that have an absolute high impact, low impact quality to them.
Yeah, I personally find what you're talking about to be the easiest kind of substitution with a whole plethora of Asian stuff. So like, even if it's like black vinegar or ponzu sauce or something like this, where it's like really not messing with my calories, but it's really creating, you know.
Go ahead. We talk about the idea of like the opposing flavors on your tongue that make that simulation happen. When you talk about ponzu sauce, you've got, salt and acid, which are real, like your tongue only tastes four things, right? And then everything else, all the other flavors that we think of when we think about the complexity of food come from our olfactory or nose or smell, or we're smelling stuff. That was highlighted to me recently. I got COVID, lost my sense of smell. And it was like, whoa, this thing I knew, you didn't know until it actually happened. And so many of us have experienced that recently. You know, when you can excite your taste buds, and I think Asian food specifically, whether it's in Chinese food where you see a lot of like sweet and salty together, or in Japan, you see a lot of sour and salty together, where it's kind of like we've had as kids, remember those like sour head candies where it's like either spicy and sour. You're taking two of the taste buds that of two of the four, and you're like overloading and your brain is confused. Whereas naturally you're sated because your fat in your stomach is slowly sending a message back up to your brain, which is why if you eat slowly, eventually you get full. Whereas, the faster you eat, you can eat more. Mm-hmm, that makes sense. So you're able to stimulate those same sated sensors in your brain with ingredients rather than with fat.
Ethan, have you messed with yuzu kosho ever? Yuzu kosho, does that sound familiar?
No.
It's a Japanese condiment that's with yuzu, so citrus, and there's pepper in it and there's salt in it. And you can cook meat. You can rub it on meat and cook with it. You can use it as a condiment in dipping sauces.
But I'm getting also, this.
It's amazing. And it's beautiful packaging. It comes in these little jars. And we write about it. We write about yuzu kosho. And it's fun part about food right now is like the collecting of condiments, right? Like,
I mean, it's amazing. That's what I do. And it's almost, I mean, it is crazy how much of it is Asian based. And then I have like my four Italian spices if I'm feeling like eating Italian food, but it is almost all Asian.
Yeah. I feel like, again, the same way that food has been food processing has made, a lot of progress. We've seen a lot of progress in import and export, right, and relations between countries, and then refrigeration. I mean, these are all not new because they've been around for 100 years, but really these technologies are just starting to become inexpensive enough that we're starting, where you can get high quality citrus from Japan in Los Angeles or in New York or Chicago,
Houston, Atlanta.
That's something that we couldn't have before. So, when every ingredient in the world is available at our fingertips, all of a sudden it opens up. And then the downside of that is obviously, what does that mean for the world? What is it doing for people? What is it doing for culture? That's a different topic.
Yeah.
We're just talking about how to make it taste as good as possible.
Well, I mean, I'm all for making it taste as good as possible. I just need to make sure that I'm not experiencing it in a compulsive way. You know what I mean? Like I'm going like, what does my body need out of this food? And I'm going to give it that. And I want to enjoy that also.
I also feel like it's so tough. Like, what does a good life mean? And how healthy should I be for it to be before it becomes unhealthy? I mean, I've definitely have friends that are health obsessed to the level where, it takes over everything in their lives. And, ultimately that's for each individual to choose if going to the gym all day and really having a super austere diet brings you joy, then that's what brings you joy. As a person whose life revolves around food, 165 pounds is my fight weight. 180 pounds is my happy weight. 100, mm-hmm. you know, 200 pounds is my
COVID weight.
200 pounds is my, you know, I can't touch my toes and I'm having a hard time tying my shoes without panting weight. You know, we got to find the balance, but I'm happier at 180 than I am at 165. Each individual.
Yeah.
100%. And I can only associate places with food, and I'm not going to lose my, I love to travel and I'm not going to ever lose that because, you know, and I've done it where I'm on a diet and I'm miserable. And then I've done it where I've gone like, if I'm mostly adhering to my plan, but I'm going to have cacio e pepe in Rome, that's okay too, you know, or something like that, something of that nature. I went to China just to eat roast duck in an alleyway because that was my China trip. You know what I mean? And so that's what I enjoyed doing in China. I also went to the Great Wall. I don't remember that nearly as much as the roast duck I had.
Where in China? Do you remember?
In Beijing, Li Kuan roast duck. Amazing. Amazing.
Writing that down.
Now you got my pen out, right?
Yeah.
Traveling for food is a cool topic. I feel like right now in this day and age, we think the foodie has been reclaimed, or foodie 2.0, and the foodie has won. We think traveling for food is obviously at the top of mind, but also creating that balance and not feeling the pressure, the cosmic pressure that you have to hit the 12 restaurants on the list. I mean, as a writer, I mean, I'm always challenged by that. I'm hanging out in LA these days and I'm challenged because I want to feel good about myself and feel healthy, but I also want to try carne asada. I want to try Korean food. I want to sample all the cuisine here. So I think striking that balance and going into the trip and having like really thinking like there's three victories I want during this trip and being like, I'm going to appreciate it in the moment, not doing it for the gram, not doing it for my story. I'm going to appreciate it in the moment. It sounds slightly corny, but I really do believe in this, that if you are in the moment when eating, ultimately that's going to be your unlock. Like that's going to make you a happier eater, as opposed to like fishing for the phone, fishing for the next place. It's that rush. Don't do that if you can. I mean, I struggle with it all the time, but.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. In an attempt to create more of a community, we are branching out and taking our Q&A episodes and the American Glutton Social Club to Patreon. We're inviting you to join us on Patreon to have more interaction, less of me talking at you and more of me talking with you. You can join today for extra episodes, discounts, and so much more, like the Patreon-only Discord. So go find me at American Glutton on Patreon.
Okay, I keep having this thought and I want to know your guys' take on it. I buy every new gadget. I had a pressure cooker long before there was the Instapot. And at the time, I could only find one that was so big. It was made for kitchens. This is like maybe 15 years ago. I actually wound up giving it to a chef, a buddy of mine named Alon Hall, because it took so long to build up the pressure and I wasn't ever cooking for more than like four people. And so he still uses it in his kitchen.
We're friends with this guy.
Oh, good.
I like this man.
He's a good dude. He's a good dude. He's actually a guy who has completely changed the way I look at vegetables. Like I'm not such a huge fan of vegetables, but the stuff he does with them, I'm like, I want to eat those vegetables when you cook them. He's a good, solid dude. But what about gadgets? Because I have the sous vide machine. I have two different air fryers. I have, you know, every single food. I have a smoker, I have a barbecue, like every single thing, food processors, blenders. What is a thing that you think of that is super handy to have that can maybe stop somebody from being me?
the word. So basically, first of all, we have a whole chapter in Food IQ that's tools and technology, basically, where we take, you know, the 12 kind of like most talked about gadgets in the kitchen are the ones that we think are the most important. And we talk about how to use them. And we take an Instant Pot and we really say, you know, as a chef, it's very, 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 it's very popular to be snooty and snobby and say, you know, an Instant Pot is for, you know, dilettantes or whatever. But the reality is that many of these tools have, if used for the right purpose, are really, really helpful. My personal, and it's such an embarrassing thing to say, my, like, your iPhone, your smartphone is probably your number one tool in the kitchen, right? It's the thing you're reaching for. It's the calculator. It's your recipes. So there's no question about it that has a place in the kitchen. Give me a stick, two sticks, and I'll make fire and cook you a delicious meal, or ceviche without a stick involved at all, no fire.
But so you need a good knife for the ceviche.
If buying a tool or a new gadget is going to inspire you to spend more time in the kitchen, then there's no bad aspect, right? For me, the more time you spend with food, the easier, the faster it becomes, the more healthy and the more of a habit it is for you, the better, right? And whatever entices you to do that is great.
For me, honestly, it's really good scissors. I mean it. I think extremely, like, I think you can get KitchenAid, you can get Henkel, but I really think having a sharp pair of scissors that are always there for you and not being scared to touch food with those scissors. So opening a package of chicken with those scissors, cutting vegetables, cutting a salad, like elements of a salad with scissors. To me, it's ultimately having that sanitary set and having that unsanitary set and being comfortable using it. I think that's simple. Also, a really good rice cooker that costs like $45. Japanese models I've always enjoyed. I just feel like that to me, and rice, you know, you can debate if rice is something you want to eat a lot of, but I think in moderation, it's great. But ultimately, cooking rice can be challenging on the stovetop. I think it can be challenging. And if you're not balancing water and starch, it's going to, you know, there's going to be some issues. So
rice is a nightmare. Making rice is a total nightmare. And how much do you rinse it? And is it, I've a rice cooker. I completely agree with you. If you're eating rice, it's a game changer.
So to answer the question about washing it, I would wash it twice. I think you throw away the first water, keep that second water around and cook with it. So say you're making like a Korean stew or making any kind of soup and you need a stock and you don't want to use better than bouillon, which by the way is totally cool. We talk about bouillon, but use that rice water as a base. It's delicious. It is full of that starchy water. It adds texture, adds a little bit of flavor and umami. And then rice, rinse it one more time. So three times. That's just like my quick answer for rice. Do you disagree? Do disagree sometimes, by the way.
So. But I think you got to rinse it even if it's in a rice cooker. Rice on the stovetop for me I've never. If I make it well, I've won the lottery.
Obviously, you know, there are techniques when you want that starch, like with risotto specifically, you want that starch and you don't rinse your rice specifically.
Good point.
When you're making a, what's the
congee?
You know, the big pan where you
paella.
Paella, you don't necessarily rinse rice. So I think that there are techniques where you want the starch, but when you want the individual kernels of rice, then rinsing them plays a big part. Ultimately, rice cookery is an art. You know, I was embarrassed about 5 or 6 years ago. A friend of mine said, "Hey, I want to cook." You know, was cooking with him, he and his new wife as a present. And he said, "You know, I want to make this rice dish," and I just ruined it. I mean, it was mushy garbage. And I thought, this is so embarrassing. You know, I'm this kind of like accoladed chef. You like to say that? Accoladed?
Yeah, acclaimed, minor acclaim.
I'm this genius. I'm smart guy. and I was really embarrassed. And then I really went home and I've spent the last really 5 years making it my goal to learn how to cook rice. And it's spectacular. I mean, a lot of the world sustains itself on rice cookery. Rice is a magical green.
Yotam Ottolenghi.
You buy his cookbook and, you know, he has 5 or 6 different rice preparations in there that take days. It's spectacular. And the outcome is, I mean, it'll blow your mind.
Or
is it all stovetop?
Stovetop cooking, you know, a lot of, you know, either steamed preparations where it's par cooked and then mixed with other ingredients, then cooked further, or rinsed for a long time, you know, soaked overnight, soaked for hours and then steamed. And you find, you know, you can really get into it. Rice, kind of like the same way that flour you know, really simple grain is the base of so much of our food, you know, so many bread, so many different varied foods. Rice has the same kind of, has the same ability. It has a ton of different applications. Mm-hmm. Really, really phenomenal.
I've made glutinous rice, and you have to soak that for a long time and then steam it. And that actually, I think I did okay with, but just like, I want a cup of rice with my food and I'm going to throw something on the stovetop, I always fail.
Yeah. The rice cooker helps. I mean, realistically though, if next time you do it, put it in a pot of water and just like you're getting the starch out, put it in a pot of water and soak it.
Yeah. The soaking is good too.
With a pinch of salt. You soak it for a pinch of salt for whatever it is, a half an hour, and then cook it with less water than you think, and you'll probably come
out. And once again, the callback to what we were talking about earlier is it's cooking is not about the active time, it's about the preparation, and it's picking the moment. So you decide you want to have that great rice experience. It might not be right after work when you just arrived home, you know, from daycare or for wherever, from the gym. It might not be the moment, and being okay and accepting that might not be the moment to make rice. It might be a moment to actually, you know, let's put some frozen fish in the microwave.
Right.
7 minutes of microwaving.
The other thing about rice is rice freezes really well, you know, so
that's good.
Rice freezes and microwave reconstitutes really well. So like when you do make rice, you make a pot of rice, you take it, you put it in Ziploc bags or freezer safe bags, you throw them in the freezer as portions, and you take that portion bag, throw it in your microwave for, you know, whatever it is, 2 minutes, and you get perfect fresh. Every family that I know of that eats a lot of rice
has a freezer
full of bags of rice.
Also herbs too. Yeah. Herbs freeze extremely well, which I think sometimes is forgotten. So if you have a wonderful garden and you got all these herbs, you can freeze your herbs.
Was part of you guys wanting to write this noticing how many people just suddenly were reliant on DoorDash or Uber Eats or Postmates during the pandemic? Was that part of it?
I don't hate the, as a restaurant guy, I'm a big fan of you ordering in. Thank you very much. You know, I've got a pizzeria and, you know, every time you order pizza, it's a win for me. So I don't think there's anything negative about that. I think a big part of it was just the joy that both of us have from cooking from completely different perspectives. It's like when you get your first bicycle as a kid and all of a sudden your world opens up. You know, when you buy your first house as an adult and all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, you have your first kid. And next thing you know, it's like my world changes upside down. Learning to cook it really opens up your world in the same way, where it's just, you get so much more out of life. Food is so much easier and faster and cheaper and pleasureful. And, you know, when you go to the farmer's market, for me, I go to the farmer's market, I want to buy everything. It's like I'm going to Toys R Us as a kid. Mm-hmm. I think Toys R Us is
probably in chapter 11, but it's a good reference book for the older generation. Right. I'll answer that question. We wrote this book because we felt that there were people who were just on the edge of becoming really active, happy home cooks. They just had these questions that they needed. They were so close. Yes, they might have had an active DoorDash account, but they were also, you know, that pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, you know, entertaining a lot, having people over and wanting to, you know, flex in that way, which is great. And we felt like people, the generation Gen Z, millennials, Xers, like all sorts of generations were kind of in the same boat. It kind of crossed generations. And we felt that if you had these 100 answers, these 100 questions and these 100 answers, you'd be so much closer to having those active cooking, like that pleasurable moment that Daniel's speaking about, that real deep pleasure of home cooking. It's just like sometimes you just don't know who to ask or what to ask. So we're kind of taking,
like, not that complicated. It's like you just cooking.
I might debate that.
Cooking is
can be complicated.
It's overcomplicate it, man. They make it it's seem, true. You know, it's like we all want, it's all self-aggrandizing. As you know, you're a chef, you want to write a recipe. It's like, it has to be more, you know, you don't want to just say it's so simple, man. And unfortunately, the simpler it is, the more, it comes down to your own personal experience of being able to know exactly when it's done, right? Like the simpler the recipe, the more important individual ingredients and cooking technique become, because there's nothing to hide behind. This is the complicated, but
I'm calling you out on that one. Honestly, do not agree whatsoever with really? That. Cooking is extremely difficult at times. Cooking is, it takes a lifetime to master cooking.
So like Othello?
Like Othello.
I think also if you're cooking for other people, there's a lot of weight on your shoulders. Like for me, if I'm just cooking for myself and I make something that's not great, then it's like, okay, I didn't make this great. I'll eat it anyway, whatever. It doesn't matter. But if you're sitting at a table with people and you're serving them something that you know is not good, that can really suck.
I'll say too, economics play. We can't hide from that fact. When you're shopping for a dinner party, you've spent $300 on everything and you started burning, you know, the halibut that you spent like $78 on. I mean, it's very, very, very tough. And well,
hopefully you now have some frozen cod that you can microwave and serve and surprise the hell out of them.
I'll say this, chefs are the cheapest people, and Daniel can back me up on this. And I think in a good way, chefs are cheap. And in the book, we talk about money a lot because money shouldn't be hidden. You shouldn't like hide from money. I think food writing has unfortunately been a very entitled world for many people, and it's been very privileged. And like money, we got to talk about money with a lot of things in life. And like, we talk about just ways that you don't have to, you know, spend the amount of money that you think you have to spend. And beef is a great example. I mean, there's a lot of examples. I mean,
you have to spend $35 on our cookbook, but after that, again, it's about empowering you to make the decisions you want to make so that you feel confident when you're buying the fancy steak that you're not going to screw it up and waste your money. But as importantly, equally importantly, you understand that, you know, chicken thighs have the most flavor, are the are the least expensive cut of the chicken, and you shouldn't shy away. You know, Americans are programmed with the most expensive is the best. And God bless our economy and the fact that we're all, you know, got toothbrushes and it's a wonderful life to live today for us. But choosing the expensive ingredient isn't always the best way to go. And certainly the more you learn about cooking, the more it opens up your ability to make those choices.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Gals, have you ever seen a professional bodybuilder at the gym? They almost always, and this is in fair or foul weather, come in wearing at least one sweatshirt. Usually the hood is pulled up, and oftentimes there's a towel crammed in there to keep even the slightest breeze off their necks. And when the sweatshirt comes off, watch out for the ubiquitous tank top underneath. Well, you know where you can get sweatshirts, gym towels, and tank tops? The American Glutton Store, that's where. And fellas, don't think we've left you out. We've got windbreakers for the real savages. Anyone working out in a windbreaker has unlocked legend status in my book. And if your feet get cold when you're wearing shoes, we've got socks too. Visit AmericanGlutton.net/shop today and level up your gym game. That's AmericanGlutton.net/shop.
I think it does come down to like how you were raised, but like I will prefer, you know, a hot dog in Echo Park to a hot dog at Pink's that you have to stand online for. And then I'll eat musubi with one of my kids while the other three and my wife are nauseated that we're eating meat that came out of a can. You know what I mean? Like this is a very big turnoff to them. So I think that kind of stuff plays a deal, but I do naturally think that A5 Wagyu is going to be better than, you know, Ralph's sirloin.
Look, there's no question about that there are ingredients that have more energy put into them and have an inherent quality. And a Ralph's sirloin versus A5 Wagyu, it's like you're saying, hey, you think that, you know, Ralph's eggs are not as good as caviar. And it's like, well, it's certainly, if you're trying to make an omelet, the eggs are going to be a lot better than the caviar. But as a delicacy and a specialty ingredient on, you know, on New Year's Eve, when I'm toasting my year's accomplishments and looking forward to a new one. Yeah, I want something special. And Wagyu, you know, Japanese Wagyu beef is very, very, very special. I mean, and a ton of energy goes into raising something specifically to make it the most delicious thing it can possibly be. Yeah.
We write about Wagyu, by the way, on, as an aside, American Wagyu versus Kobe versus Japanese A5. And it's an interesting topic, the beef production in East Asia. I feel like it definitely has great marketing, you know, hallelujah to marketing. One thing about cuts of meat and prices, like, I mean, braising, slow cooking, braising is how you take a cheap cut. We address cheap cuts. And how do you, it's time and it's using the right flavors. We talked about that on this conversation too. And it's really like being able to have the confidence of a slow braise for that dinner party versus a grilling of a massive ribeye tomahawk that you've paid two bills for. They're both very, very, very good and both very acceptable. Honestly, a home cooked meal as a host, you know, cooking for your friends and family. I think we as home cooks put too much pressure on ourselves to make it look Instagram worthy or Bon Appetit magazine cover worthy. Ultimately, it's the hospitality, it's the love in the room. I mean, it sounds corny, but I mean it. You really just like the home cooking nature of it is sometimes all it takes.
Yeah, no. And if you experiment with these things, given the right day, I could prefer simply the tendon on a well-cooked short rib to a bone-in ribeye. It just depends. I'm not saying every single time, but that can be good too.
I look, man, I always have steaks in my freezer because I know that when I'm hungry, when I've had a bad day and I feel like I really need to pick me up, a grilled steak is my that cut of meat, that lean, that more tender, quick cooked, you know, medium rare cut of meat is my favorite. And I don't know whether that's advertising and programming, that fact that it's more expensive and I feel like I'm treating myself or what exactly it is, but that does hit a pleasure center for me that the other thing doesn't. So I think there's truth in what you're saying. And I don't know whether there, you know, it's like nature versus nurture. Is that inherent to is mm-hmm. why is that? I don't know. It's delicious is why. Yeah. You know, however, there's no question about it that each and that's culturally, there are people that say, you know, a warm bowl of fried rice is the thing that that brings me that, you know, steak doesn't do it for me at all. It's a warm bowl of fried rice
or raw cookie dough. Like shout to right. raw cookie dough. I mean, sweet tooth in us. Me, I'm like Reese's peanut butter cups, like the holiday edition. I'll rank those. I'll say the trees are the over the Valentine's, the hearts over the Easter eggs. That's my hierarchy. I think about these things. That to me is my comfort pleasure center. So I think it really just depends on who you are.
I mean, yeah. God, country, family, we can organize it any way we want, but
but it's gotta be those three.
But when you look at the, you know, meat that we eat and you say, well, you know, there are definitely people that argue, hey, goat is the greatest meat. And I say, well, you know, it could be the greatest tasting for you. But if you were to get all the people together and you were looking, the beautiful thing about about capitalism is people get to vote with their dollars every single day. And there's unbiased information out there for what people like the most based on what we spend our money on. And we eat a lot more chicken than goat. We eat a lot more chicken than pork. We eat a lot more chicken than we eat a lot of chicken. Yeah. People like chicken.
Yeah.
Chicken tastes the best.
Can I defend goat for a minute? I eat meat. I like meat. I'm a fan of meat. The only place I went to a restaurant called Carnivore in Johannesburg, South Africa, and it was all game meat. And I ate some shit there that was not good. But goat, for people who are squirmy about this kind of thing, I like lamb too, but goat is actually less gamey than lamb, I have found. And as far as like, I just want to defend goat because goat is a meat that none of my kids would ever touch until I took them for birria tacos and they ate it. And then I said, by the way, this is goat. And they were all flabbergasted.
There's a place by this old, the Staples Center called El Perion, and they had cabrito tacos there. I used to go there every time I was in LA. I mean, goat tacos, there's a
delicious
real magic there. Absolutely.
I got to say this. So
you're not a goat guy. You're not a goat guy.
It's not that. It's not that here's the thing, right? You were talking about lamb. I have a friend of mine who has a company. It's called Heritage Foods USA, right?
I am very familiar with them. Yes, great company. Yes, I've ordered lots of meat from them.
Okay, so, you know, I know Patrick very, very well for years and years and years. And we've, you know, he has all of these different breeds of lamb. Like he'll have five different different types of lambs from all over the world that have different heritages and histories. And you can cook some of them and they're extremely gamey. Some of them have, you know, they all have different qualities. And so when we're talking about judging the inherent quality of an animal, it's like, man, it's so much more complicated than that. Something is great for grilling. Something's great. That same strong flavor, you know, is going to last through a long braising and give you a delicious outcome. Whereas the more mild animal might, that flavor would dissipate and it would be fairly bland at the end of the cooking. Whereas if you're grilling and eating it right away, the flavor is too pungent and overpowering. So I think, you know, it's, I said it was simple at the beginning of it. It can be simple, but there, you know, the more you learn, like anything else, the more you unpack, the more there is to find.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think preparation is very, very integral to this conversation. And I just had to defend goat because I'm a big fan of goat. Curried goat, jerk goat, delicious stuff.
I guess I disparaged goat. I didn't mean to.
How dare you?
Yeah,
any place in the world where people have a choice of whether to eat goat or not eat goat, they eat less goat.
I think you're probably right.
You're digging this hole, buddy. You're digging this hole, man.
I have one more question, and this is knives. I have 4 insanely expensive knives that I hide from my wife and kids. And then I have some very expensive knives that I let them destroy. What are your thoughts on knives? Like, do you have to get the Wusthof $300 chef's knife in order to chop up a salad?
I'll say quickly, because I know he's a long answer. He's the chef. These are his tools. I went to Tokyo Hands in Tokyo and Shibuya. I paid $36 for a plastic handled Japanese carbon steel knife. And I use it and sharpen it and I love it. So my sister-in-law owns a restaurant. She uses rubber handled knives there. They're great. They do the job. They're disposable. So that's my short answer. You have a longer answer, chef. Go, chef. No,
it depends, right?
Look, if you're kind of asking the question, like what kind of car do you drive or what kind of t-shirt do you wear? Yeah. And you know, as a young man, I used to think, well, I don't understand why anybody would spend more. Like, I got a set of Fruit of the Loom or Hanes t-shirts that are, you know, 3 for $7, and they're just as good as your t-shirt. They do exact. My car doesn't need to go more than 73 miles an hour because anything over 65 is illegal. So like, what is the point of quality or luxury beyond what you can use it or need it for? And the answer is, I don't know. There's something intangible about having something that is so there are qualities in knives, like, you know, Victorinox knives, which are inexpensive, are often what professional butchers reach for. They're easy to sharpen because their steel is a bit softer. They have great, great quality, and I use them all the time. I have the Wusthof knives that are, I think, my favorite for a home cook. They're a little bit harder steel. They sharpen very well, but then they hold their edge in a way that I think the home chef maybe doesn't sharpen their knives as often or doesn't know how. So that becomes the challenge. And then I've got super fancy Japanese knives that are handmade because they're beautiful items that have a tactile quality that when you use them, it's like a work of art and it's special. And you feel, you know, like that. What's the movie where they use the fancy sword to kill people? Like one of those.
Fruit Ninja, the game on the.
So that there's tangible and intangible aspects, but ultimately the care that you have for your knife, how sharp your knife is and learning to sharpen or having somebody that can sharpen your knife for you. That's really what's like an inexpensive knife that's sharpened is better than a dull fancy knife.
Yeah.
7 days a week and twice on Sundays, whether or not you go to church.
But
right. And the expensive ones, you still have to sharpen. Like I remember when I didn't really understand anything, I got some of these knives thinking, well, this knife is going to be exactly the same for the next 20 years and I don't have to do anything to it. No such luck on that.
Just like roasting a chicken in 20 minutes, there are certain things that are just, unfortunately, you know, like you only get so much energy out of a gallon of gas, like, you know, no knife stays sharp forever.
Yeah.
But there's a deep pleasure in shopping for a knife, I must say. Going to Corin in the city in New York or going to some some of these specialty shops in LA. It's just something, it's like collecting watches and cars and baseball cards. I mean, collecting knives is its own
thing. Something for every price bracket. Maybe you could afford to, you know, collect cars or, you know, baseball cards. We're knife guys.
That's a, right? Yeah, we're knife. It's very
true. I'm a knife guy too. I like knives. I have a huge.
In Texas, you get guns and boots, you know?
Yeah, it really depends. Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much. This was so awesome, and I really, really am excited about your book.
I want to cook with you. Yeah. I want to have dinner and cook with you. That would make me very happy.
Let's make it. I would love that. Yeah. I want to say the last time I prepared A5 Wagyu was the time that I made good sticky rice. Ooh. And I laid the A5 over it and then blowtorched it for a couple of seconds.
Did you do a sauce?
There was no sauce.
No sauce needed. The fat. No,
a little bit of salt. Yeah.
A little salt. Salt, lemon or lime.
No, but now that you say that, I feel a regret that it should have been some lemon or lime. There should have been a little acid. See, this is how I want to improve.
Yeah, I had a steak that's like great steak, Italian steak. It was the first time they put olive oil and lemon on it. I thought, you know, that's so weird. Like American, I never would put olive oil, would never put lemon on a steak. But then it's like the acid cuts through the fat and it cleans your taste buds between bites.
In Tuscany, yeah, they just know how to do it. I mean, it's insane in Central Korea and Japan, where those big, you know, beef producing areas. It's amazing.
I was never a fan of arugula until I had it served under a steak in that preparation with a little olive oil and lemon. And then you go like, holy shit, this is a magical vegetable.
Yeah, there's so much of the interplay of food where, you know, bitter on its own might not excite your palate. But when you pair it with something sweet, all of a sudden it like resets and gets you ready. You know, that's one tip I'll leave you with here, which is when something when something is not sweet enough, like we tend to think, well, we should add sugar. But if you think about adding the opposite flavor, it brings out the sweetness. So if I have a pear, for instance, not very sweet, I squeeze a little lemon on it, the pear tastes more sweet. Oh, completely wow. Crazy for us as humans to think like I added something sour and it made it taste more sweet. But just like orange juice and toothpaste, our tongue is reset by every single thing we eat, and it and recalibrates.
It's treble and bass. Think of it that way. It's like calibrating treble and bass. And sometimes when you turn up the treble, the bass will feel absolutely different, even though you have the bass in the same setting. That's the way I kind of look at music wise.
I am gonna literally try this today at my next meal. I'm gonna figure out what it's lacking and try the opposite.
Amazing,
guys.
You're the man, brother.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee. You can follow us on Instagram at American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.